From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Agnes Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. The National Rifle Association CEO Wayne LaPierre railed against the idea of new gun restrictions. He spoke today at the Conservative Political Action Conference a little more than a week after the deadly shooting in Parkland, Florida.
The elites don't care not one whit about America's school system and school children. If they truly cared, what they would do is they would protect them. For them, it's not a safety issue. It's a political issue. They want to sweep right under the carpet the failure of school security, the failure of family, the failure of America's mental health system, and even the unbelievable failure of the FBI.
Meanwhile, President Donald Trump tweeted his support for the NRA today, calling LaPierre a great American patriot. But the president also said he's in favor of strengthening background checks, raising the legal age to purchase a gun, and banning the sale of bump stocks. So let's take a look at all this with NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi there, Domenico.
Hi there.
So the president met with some lawmakers or spoke with some lawmakers today. How much of his support for those possible changes in gun laws do you think are shared amongst other folks in Washington?
Well, the president certainly needs to think about what he wants to do because he's had so much political pressure on him that he feels like he needs to come away with saying that there's something concrete that he can take back and sell to the American public and say that he got XYZ through Congress.
Well, I mean, he was tweeting today that he's promising to get the job done. But on the other hand, I mean, the NRA has an influential position here in terms of its funding of lawmakers and what LaPierre was saying today. So how is that influence going to play into all this?
Well, and absolutely. You know, President Trump sort of flip-flopped on his support for an assault weapons ban in 2000 in order to be able to try to win the Republican primary and got the full NRA support. And, you know, what you heard from LaPierre is really par for the course for what he does. He deflected, as you heard there, to lots of other things that aren't gun-related. He also called for, quote, effective trained armed security at schools. Again, sort of going with that theme of the only thing to beat a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. You know, big picture here, the message that the NRA is sending to supporters is, you know, not just LaPierre, but on social media, other speakers at CPAC was stand up for the NRA's principles. Don't cow to the other side, especially now, because this is all part of a liberal socialist conspiracy brought to you by Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, and the media. So, you know, this is an organization that's under assault every time there's a shooting, and they've become pretty adept at raising money and triggering membership to really think about getting their backs up in the aftermath of these kinds of events.
You know, we've seen some interesting polling, though, about what Americans as a whole think about guns and gun laws at this moment. I mean, how might that influence Congress when it comes back from recess?
Well, the real work is going to be, as you note, you know, Congress coming back, which is next week. From a substantive standpoint, LaPierre supports strengthening or tightening the background check system, which there's a bill going through to do that. Mm-hmm. But people fed up with the number of mass shootings don't really see that as enough. Yeah. Usually it's the NRA applying pressure, but now, last night we saw with Marco Rubio, the political pressure was coming the other direction.
NPR's Domenico Montanaro, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, there were some extraordinary moments yesterday in the national debate on school shootings and gun control, and we want to listen now to some extended clips, starting with Andrew Pollack, whose daughter, Meadow, was one of the Parkland victims. He spoke during President Trump's listening session at the White House.
It doesn't make sense. Fix it. Should have been one school shooting, and we should have fixed it. And I'm pissed, because my daughter I'm not going to see again. She's not here. She's not here. She's in North Lauderdale at whatever it is, King David Cemetery. That's where I go to see my kid now. And it stops. We all work together and come up with the right idea, and it's school safety. It's not about gun laws right now. That's another fight, another battle. Let's fix the schools, and then you guys can battle it out whatever you want. But we need our children safe. Monday, tomorrow, whatever day it is, your kids are going to go to school. You think everyone's kids are safe? I didn't think it was going to happen to me. If I knew that, I would have been at the school every day if I knew it was that dangerous. It's enough. Let's get together, work with the president, and fix the schools.
Parkland shooting survivor Sam Zeif also gave an emotional plea to President Trump.
I turned 18 the day after. Woke up to the news that my best friend was gone. And I don't understand why I could still go in a store and buy a weapon of war, an AR. I was reading today that a person 20 years old walked into a store and bought an AR-15 in 5 minutes with an expired ID. How is it that easy to buy this type of weapon? How do we not stop this after Columbine, after Sandy Hook? I'm sitting with a mother that lost her son. It's still happening. In Australia, there was a shooting at a school in 1999. And, you know, after that, they took a lot of ideas. They put legislation together. And they stopped it. Can anyone here guess how many shootings there have been in the schools since then in Australia? Zero. We need to do something. And that's why we're here.
The president weighed in himself, talking about the need to arm teachers. He mentioned a coach who was killed last week in Parkland.
The coach had a firearm in his locker when he ran at this guy. That coach was very brave. Saved a lot of lives, I suspect. But if he had a firearm, he wouldn't have had a run. He would have shot, and that would have been the end of it. And this would only be, obviously, for people that are very adept at handling a gun. And it would be, it's called concealed carry, where a teacher would have a concealed gun on them. They'd go for special training, and they would be there, and you would no longer have a gun-free zone.
Sandy Hook Promise co-founder Nicole Hockley, whose son Dylan was killed in Newtown, Connecticut, responded to the president.
I appreciate the point on arming teachers. It's not personally something that I support. Rather than arm them with a firearm, I would rather arm them with the knowledge of how to prevent these acts from happening in the first place. How do you identify the kids in your class that are most at risk? And then, most importantly, within a school, how do we have a safety assessment program so that schools know how to deal with all these threats, have established protocols to deal with them, and get underneath the surface of what's going on in that child's life, find out why they're on this pathway behavior, and intervene.
Last night, the conversation continued at a CNN town hall with Republican Senator Marco Rubio taking questions from audience members, including victims of gun violence. Here's Rubio's interaction with Fred Guttenberg, whose 14-year-old daughter, Jamie, was killed in Parkland.
Look at me and tell me guns were the factor in the hunting of our kids in this school this week. And look at me and tell me you accept it and you will work with us to do something about guns.
Fred, I'm not, first of all, let me explain what I said this week, and I'll repeat it. I'll repeat what I said. And what I said, and then I'm going to tell you what we're going to do. We're going to talk about guns, and we're going to talk about what I said this week. And here's what I said. I said that the problems that we are facing...
Let him speak. I think we need to hear it.
The audience quieted down, and Rubio continued.
I'm saying that the problems that we're facing here today cannot be solved by gun laws alone. And I'm going to tell you what we've done already and what I hope we'll do moving
forward.
Were
guns the factor in the hunting of our kids?
Absolutely. Of course they were. And here's what
the weapon of choice. Can you say that?
Number one, Fred, I absolutely believe that in this country, if you are 18 years of age, you should not be able to buy a rifle, and I will support a law that takes that right away.
Fantastic.
Cameron Caskey, a student from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, also asked Rubio at the CNN town hall whether he would pledge not to take any more money from the NRA. Here's Rubio's response.
I will answer any questions you guys have about any policy.
Right now, guys, be quiet. You know,
and I just think that ultimately that is not our goal here. Our goal here is to move forward.
Wait, so hold on.
In
the name of 17 people, you cannot ask the NRA to keep their money out of your campaign?
I think in the name of 17 people, I can pledge to you that I will support any law that will prevent a killer like this.
No, but I'm talking NRA money.
No, because
Matter of fact, guys, I bet we can get people in here to give you exactly as much money as the NRA would have.
But it's not. I understand. And you're right.
Can you stand up and donate to that real quick?
The CNN town hall closed with the Stoneman Douglas Drama Club performing their original song, Shine, that they wrote in response to the shooting. The students stopped midway through to make a statement.
We refuse to be ignored by those who will not listen. There are so many things you can do to become involved. Reach out to your congressman, mail, call, and tweet.
The smallest of words can make the biggest difference.
Be the voice for those who don't have one.
Together, we have the power to change the world around us.
Some of the incredible moments yesterday, we'll link you to more at hereandnow.org. The Oscars are coming up on March 4th, which means it's time for our annual look at the nominees in the category for Best Original Song. Joining us now is John Burlingame. He writes for Variety and teaches film music history at the University of Southern California. John, welcome back.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And what were your thoughts on the nominees this year?
I think, you know, there's such a wide range of styles and musical colors in the Best Song nominees. It may be the best batch in years, I think.
Wow. Well, let's get right to them then. This is Mighty River from the film Mudbound. It's written by Mary J. Blige, Raphael Sadiq, and Tara Stinson. Here it is.
Time tells no lies. It keeps changing and ticking and moving then. Passes by, but if you're lucky, it will be kind, like a river flowing through time.
Like a river,
let it wash it clean.
Like a river,
going upstream.
Like a river,
cutting through.
And this is Mary J. Blige performing here. She's also up for an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress for her role in Mudbound. What are your thoughts on this nomination?
I love this song. It's wonderfully soulful and maybe even a touch of gospel flavor. It plays at the end of the movie, though, and Mudbound is a fairly long film. So I wonder whether it has a really strong shot at the win. What's positive about this is that Mary J. Blige is nominated both for, as you point out, Supporting Actress and for Best Song. That's a first. That's never happened before in the Oscar races. And so one wonders if they choose someone else in the Supporting Actress category, does that give Mary J. Blige a better shot at the song win?
Oh, the politics of the Oscars, wow.
Oh, yes, you have no idea.
Well, and is that something that is a negative, that it plays at the end of the movie instead of during the film?
It can be. More than ever these days, you find audiences leaving the theater, or in the case of a Netflix choice, turning off the film before the end titles or as the end titles begin. And so very often they don't hear the song. And that is a factor that plays a role in Academy members choosing what they want to vote for. Because if they haven't heard the song, it's not going to matter.
Okay, the next song is from Call Me By Your Name. This is Mystery of Love. It's written and performed by Sufjan Stevens. Let's listen.
Oh, to see without my eyes the first time that you kissed me, boundless by the time I cried. I built your walls around me, white noise, what an awful sound. Fumbling by Rogue River, feel my feet above the ground.
Really lovely, wistful song there. Does it seem like Oscar material to you?
I love this song. I could listen to this over and over all day long, and in fact, I have. It's gentle, it's ethereal, maybe a touch mystical. I can't wait to see this performed that night. I wonder exactly how they're going to do that. I give it a shot as a potential consolation prize Oscar. That is, if the film doesn't win anything else, what sometimes happens at the Oscars is that members shift their attention to the music categories to give a film they really liked but isn't going to win anything else a music prize. However, I think this has a very strong shot at winning the Adapted Screenplay Oscar, which means that our famed indie folk artist, Mr. Stevens, may be out of luck this year. Still, it's wonderful. I think, you know, what they always say, that the nomination is really the win, and I'm delighted that they chose this as one of the top five.
Okay, well, let's get to the next song nomination, and this is the one that I think is going to win. I'm interested to see if you agree. That would be Remember Me from Coco. Disney and Pixar almost always have a nominee in this category. This is a song that appears several times in the film. Here's a version performed by Anthony Gonzalez. He's the voice of Miguel.
Remember me, though I have to say goodbye. Remember me, don't let it make you cry. For even if I'm far away, I hold you in my heart. I sing a secret song to you each night we are apart. Remember me.
And this song is really key to the film Coco.
And that is why it may in fact win. Because people forget that the choice for best song is not for the best song. It's for the best use of music and lyrics in the dramatic context of a film. And so, number one, Coco was hugely popular. Everybody saw it. That's the first hurdle you have to get over. Once you've seen the film, then you choose the song that is best used dramatically in the context of the picture. And this is, as you point out, it's a key element in the narrative itself. And I love the choice that you just made of Miguel singing it in that final scene. You know, people were weeping in the theater at the end of this movie in large measure because of that clip that you just played. So I think that, and we should mention the songwriters, Bobby Lopez and Kristen Anderson Lopez. It's true they won the Oscar a few years ago for Let It Go from Frozen, but they have a very strong shot, I think, this year at repeating.
Okay, but we still have two nominees left to get through, so let's give them their due. This is by another Oscar winner, Common, who won in 2015 with Glory, which he wrote with John Legend. He wrote this year's nominee with Diane Warren. It's called Stand Up for Something, and it's from the film Marshall.
Rise up, love, lift your hands. I stand with you because I understand. Ain't here to judge, just to take a stand. The greater plan's the creator's plan. Let's all rise like the day began. Reach out and touch with the Savior's hand. On rock we stand like his native land. Let the ways of love be the ways of man.
Now, that's Common performing along with Andra Day. John Common has won an Oscar before, but his co-writer, Diane Warren, hasn't in eight previous nominations. Why do you think she has yet to win?
Well, you know, the Oscars, let's face it, it's not always about the best song. The political environment of every year is a factor, and that, in fact, is one of the things that might give Diane a shot here. Now, number one, you're correct. This is her ninth nomination. She's never won. And she is much beloved in both the songwriting community and in the Hollywood community. And that may be a factor in the choice. The problem is not a lot of people saw Marshall. And again, this is an end title song, which is that, you know, that complicates matters. But here's the interesting thing. A lot of people have made a lot about the fact that Diane has never won and that maybe this is her time. Plus, a lot of people saw Lady Gaga sing her song Till It Happens to You on the Oscars 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that performance was so powerful that a lot of people walked away regretting not voting for it instead of the theme for a James Bond film. And that may resonate and give this song a lot more juice going into the voting period.
Okay, finally, John, we've got Benj Pasek and Justin Paul, who won an Oscar last year for co-writing La La Land, City of Stars. And this year, they're up for another one for This Is Me from The Greatest Showman.
When the sharpest words wanna cut me down, gonna send a flood, gonna drown a mind. I am brave, I am bruised, I am who I'm meant to be. This is me. Look out, cause here I come. And I'm marching on to the beat I drum. I'm not scared to be seen, I make no apologies. This is me.
This is me, performed there by Kiala Settle, who plays Letty Lutz, the bearded lady in The Greatest Showman. What do you think of this one?
Well, this is the show-stopping song from the middle of the film, and it is it's powerful both on its own as a song and within the context of the picture. This is an anthem for the marginalized, the disenfranchised, the bullied, the outcast, and I think that it will only get more so as time goes on. And in a year when diversity is on everyone's mind, that gives this song a lot of traction. These guys are the hottest songwriters in the business, having not only won the Oscar last year for La La Land, but the Tony for Dear Evan Hansen. So I think these guys have a shot. The Academy might think twice about giving the same songwriters the Oscar 2 years in a row, but if they're thinking about the material and what the song is saying, that, I think, gives it a real shot at the win. Most prognosticators are pitting Remember Me against This Is Me, and that may be true. Those are probably the number one and two choices, but this is such a fascinating field this year that I think there are multiple choices for the win.
Well, and maybe like last year, multiple people will get the win, and then they'll decide that actually one of them was wrong. And they have to take the envelope back. Hopefully not again. Poor people over there at La La Land. We've been talking with John Burlingame, who teaches film music history at the University of Southern California and writes for Variety. John, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. A new year has begun, and if you are setting new goals for your business, you need the right people on your team. And ZipRecruiter has transformed how you find them. ZipRecruiter posts your job to over 100 job boards with just one click, then actively looks for the most qualified candidates and invites them to apply. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Right now, listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Remember all those companies that promised to give workers bonuses after the federal tax cuts passed in December? Well, one of those companies does not appear to be following through. A group of unions filed a federal complaint this week against Disney, alleging that Disney is holding on to those promised bonuses and using them as leverage in contract negotiations. Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. He joins us from New York. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
So these contract negotiations affect about 35,000 Disney workers. Many make around $11 an hour. Is this the case that Disney is withholding the bonuses?
Right. So what the unions are complaining about is that the $1,000 bonus has been offered basically unconditionally to employees who are either non-union or are covered by unions that aren't in the middle of negotiating contracts. But members of these unions, you know, they cover everything from bus drivers to ride attendants and food workers. They would have to ratify the new contract in order to get this bonus. And Disney is saying they have to ratify it by the end of August or else the bonus will be revoked. But the unions have already voted against this contract. 93% voted against it because it only includes what they consider about a raise of about 50 cents an hour. So it's clear there's a lot of negotiating left to do.
Yeah, although when the company released its press release on January 23rd of this year, it says 125,000 Disney employees to receive a $1,000 cash bonus. It does call them eligible employees. I guess maybe that's what they meant.
Right. And, you know, it's possible these union employees will still get that bonus, obviously. It's just a matter of Disney kind of using it apparently as a bargaining chip in this contract negotiation.
What is Disney saying about all this?
Well, they've released statements to The Washington Post and other press outlets basically saying that wages and bonuses are part of the negotiation process And they point out that they have offered to increase pay by about 6 to 10% over the next 2 years. And they want to continue to meet with the union to move toward a ratified agreement. So they're kind of holding their ground at this point, it sounds like.
Well, one of the concerns when all these companies came out and said that they were giving these one-time bonuses is that they were using this as a way to avoid raising pay over the long term for their employees. Now, Disney's profits jumped about 80% last quarter. They're attributing at least part of that to the tax cuts. Does promising these bonuses allow companies to avoid increasing pay in the long run?
Well, I mean, a one-time bonus is exactly that. It's paid out one time, whereas corporate tax cuts are, at least in theory, they're permanent and will benefit the company every year. But I think the big question is whether these tax cuts will stimulate the economy enough to actually increase competition for labor, which would have the effect of causing wages to go higher across the board. And we'll just have to wait and see about that.
Well, there were so many companies that announced bonuses from AT&T to Best Buy. How much of these tax savings are companies going to be giving back to employees?
Well, so earlier this month, the White House said that 3.5 million American workers across more than 300 companies so far have either received bonuses or increased pay. But CNN cited a survey of analysts at Morgan Stanley today, and it found that only about 13% of companies' tax cut savings will go to pay raises, bonuses, and employee benefits. Now, this is, again, according to a survey of analysts. But 43%, according to that survey, will go to straight to investors in the form of stock buybacks and dividends.
That's Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
The United Nations says more than 300 people have been killed by government airstrikes in East Ghouta, Syria this month, hundreds more wounded, and they're in desperate need of medical attention. David Miliband is CEO of the International Rescue Committee and a former British Member of Parliament. He joins us now in the studio. Welcome back, David. And first of all, I know you've seen the same scenes that we have of East Ghouta on TV. They are truly shocking. But how bad are things there right now?
Well, the Secretary General of the United Nations yesterday said it was the modern definition of hell. And I think that is the right description, because human life is not just hanging by a thread, it's being lost. The International Rescue Committee, which I lead, has five hospitals that we're supporting in Ghouta. One of them bombed yesterday. We literally have doctors having to reuse syringes. We have credible reports of starving children. And of course, there is death and destruction from the air of an absolutely abhorrent kind.
And these are government airstrikes on rebel-held areas.
Government and Russian-supported airstrikes. Obviously, the conflict in Syria has become more complicated over the last 6 or 7 years since it began as a rather basic demand for accountable government and respect for individual freedom in Daraa in 2011 with people writing graffiti on walls. It's now a much more complicated conflict. But the essential problem at its heart, namely that the combatants to the conflict are paying no heed at all to the basics of human life or international humanitarian law, has become worse and worse, from chemical weapons to now this mass bombardment, not just in Ghouta, but where there's a siege, but in the northwest of the country, 400,000 people displaced from their homes by bombing in the last 2.5 weeks. So any hope that 2017 was going to see the end of the Syrian war, I think, is being dashed. 2018 is on track to be a bloodier year than even last year.
And insofar as these actions being taken in defiance of international law, I mean, tell me a little bit more about that. Were civilians given any opportunity to evacuate the area before the bombing began?
No, I mean, quite the opposite. The civilians are being kept into the area.
Targeted,
these are not
right.
Underground hospitals. These are well-marked hospitals. It's a deliberate campaign of indiscriminate bombing that on civilian areas. That's why people talk about war crimes, because international humanitarian law is absolutely clear after the Second World War that there is a responsibility on combatants in a conflict to spare civilians. And that is not being done both in Ghouta and elsewhere in this conflict. Obviously, the entry of the Russians in 2015 changed the dynamics of this conflict. The Obama administration was very worried, for understandable reasons, that any engagement on the military side would suck it in to a conflict. The Russians have proved that you can apply the iron fist in collaboration with the Syrian government and their Iranian backers and retake significant parts of the country, but of course not get to the heart of the political division in the country, mm-hmm. because the scale of the bloodshed, the scale of the exodus of people into neighbouring states, 5 or 6 million refugees, means that it's very hard to see how there's any kind of political compromise or political settlement in sight.
So tell me a bit more about the humanitarian efforts, the medical efforts that are going on in East Ghouta right now. I mean, how many hospitals does the IRC work with there?
We support 5 hospitals out of 19 in the area. I mean, the doctors and nurses who remain are extraordinary people, and now they have very little choice but to stay because they're sealed off. We know there are 700 to 800 people in desperate need of evacuation because they've got illnesses and diseases that need more or less immediate treatment if they are to survive. We also know that the basic primary care infrastructure, the basic care, the dialysis machines that are needed for kidney patients, the basic support for diabetics is being lost. We get supplies into there. We support the doctors and the nurses running the 5 hospitals that we support. But we are in a mission there to just keep hope, keep life going.
And but you said a little earlier that the situation is so dire that doctors have to do things such as reuse needles.
Yeah. So that's why Secretary General Guterres is right to say it's close to hell. It's the violation of every conceivable norm. And I'm afraid there's no shame on the part of the Iranian or Russian backers of the Assad regime. They'd trot out this line that they're taking on terrorists. There's very little accountability. So I want to know who are the people who ordered the bombing of the hospital that we run? And there's no accountability for that. Obviously, the trauma for the West of Afghanistan and Iraq means that there is enormous political caution in Western countries about getting involved in a conflict like that in Syria. But that means that there's free rein for people who are dissolving the very basics of humanity.
Sometimes it feels very strange to me that we are able to have this conversation in a sort of dispassionate, clinical way when the truth of what we're talking about is almost immeasurable human suffering.
Well, I don't feel dispassionate about it at all. I feel extremely passionate and angry about it because the betrayal of the civilians, the betrayal of the aid workers, we're a humanitarian charity. We have local people. It's local nurses, local doctors, local community workers who work for the International Rescue Committee. And they are there doing the essentials of humanitarian work with very little political support. So their work is meant to be clinical, but I don't think our discussion of it is clinical. What our discussion is impotent. And that is the real story of the diplomatic and political failure that Syria represents.
So let's talk about that, because I think that's a very good word to use here. What is preventing the international community? I mean, you've mentioned the UN Secretary General a couple of times. What is preventing the international community to at least put more pressure on Assad to implement some kind of ceasefire?
There's a simple answer to that, which is the Russian veto in the United Nations Security Council is blocking Security Council action. We know Sweden and Kuwait, who are 2 temporary members, 2-year members of the UN Security Council, have got a resolution down being discussed at the moment to call for a 30-day halt in the fighting and in the bombing, and that is being blocked by the Russians. We'll see whether or not the Chinese support them or whether the Chinese abstain. This follows a record of 12 or 15 similar vetoes that the Russians have applied. Now, the real test of diplomacy, of course, is not just to pass resolutions. It's what do you do when resolutions are blocked? Where is the political pressure? Where is the shame, which is a word that I've used before? Where is the linkage of actions on the Syria front to other questions where Russia or Iran have interests in the wider international system? I talk about a crisis of diplomacy because we know that the State Department is massively under strength when it comes to the deployment of ambassadors. We know that the Trump administration has said it wants to cut by 30% the amount of the number of diplomats, but also the amount of humanitarian aid. That retreat of the US is absolutely fundamental to understanding the kind of remit and impunity that exists for other actors in the international system at the moment. Because when Western countries withdraw, for all of our own faults, not to say we're perfect at all, but when we withdraw, it leaves room for very bad actors to fill the void.
And you think there are no other members of the Security Council who could step up and fill the void?
Well, there are. But remember, the point about the five permanent members of the Security Council is they have a veto. So you can't pass a resolution against a veto. I mean, the U.S. has a veto. France has a veto.
But to your point about diplomacy and finding the pathways to move forward when the threat of the veto looms constantly.
Well, the crisis of diplomacy is not just the Russian veto. The crisis of diplomacy, I live and work in New York. We're a New York headquartered humanitarian organization. In September, the world gathers in New York for the UN General Assembly. Where were the all-night sessions on Syria? Where were the all-night sessions on Yemen? Where were the all-night sessions on South Sudan? They are being lost in a definition of America's interests that is very narrow. And in a way, the approach of the administration over the last year, just to pick, to say ISIS is the be-all and end-all of American interests in Syria, has been to fall into a trap that President Assad of Syria laid 6 or 7 years ago. And he's now got the fight that he wanted. And that is a true crisis because, remember, what starts in Syria doesn't stay in Syria. Mm-hmm. It spills into Jordan and Lebanon. Jordan is the second closest ally of the United States in the Middle East. The refugees spill into Turkey. They spill into Europe. 1.5 million refugees have landed in Europe. And one of the fundamental issues that a humanitarian organization sees every day is that in an interdependent world, the problems of one country aren't confined to that country. They spill out. And either we have a sense of global conscience that learns the lessons of history, that says the untended humanitarian crisis is the source of political instability, not just the product of it, or we fail to learn that lesson at our own cost.
Well, David Miliband is president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee. His recent book is Rescue, Refugees and the Political Crisis of Our Time. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much.
Every year, more elderly people around the country are becoming homeless. According to federal housing data, more than 20% of homeless people over the age of 50 were living in shelters in 2016, and that figure doesn't include people living on the streets. In Phoenix, a senior center is working closely with this population, and as Kathy Ritchie from KJZZ reports, it's busier than ever.
Talk to some of the staff at Justice Center, and they'll tell you it doesn't take much to become homeless. A bad divorce.
I lived in a $1 million house and drove luxury cars, and it was just all gone one day.
That's Denise Holm. She's 57. For 58-year-old Rudy Solis, the end of his marriage and poor health led to him living on the streets.
I tried fighting for my disability, my Social Security disability. For some reasons, they decided to fight me. It took me long. I lost my condo, my truck, all my belongings I lost.
Both Solis and Holm now work at Justice Center. They've since rebuilt their lives, in part because of the support they received here. Anywhere between 130 and 180 seniors walk through the door every single day. For many of them,
it can be very confusing and disorienting to be homeless.
Barbara Lukowitz is Justice Center's executive director.
And to be able to come to a place and feel safe and be able to sit down and to feel clean, to have clean underwear, to have clean socks, to take a shower, to eat a meal,
are the kind of entry-level services that homeless seniors get here, even before staff work with them to figure out what benefits, like Social Security or veterans benefits, they might be entitled to. Still, just because a person gets Social Security doesn't mean it's enough to be self-sufficient. And that's part of the problem, says Lukowitz. Many seniors are falling through the cracks.
If you're only earning $600 a month in Social Security, you can't get an apartment. I mean, a studio could be $550. So what are you going to do? How are you going to pay for everything else? How are you going to pay for groceries?
Another big issue? Housing. Michael Felder helped start Justice Center 11 years ago. He was just 26 at the time.
For those who are 62 and older, they can qualify for HUD and stuff like that. For those in between 55 and 61, it's more difficult, you know. It's a lot difficult to try and find them housing and employment. So we just do what we can do.
Which is pretty much everything, from furnishing a person's new home or bringing them a bag of food at the end of the month when money is really tight, to providing showers and laundry service, even mail. Justice Center is one of the only places in the country, for that matter, that offer these kinds of services. And Lukowitz says they don't rely on government funds. They operate on donations.
Coffee, cups, garbage bags. It sounds simple, but those are things that are used every day at Justice Center. Laundry soap, that's an important part of what we do.
It's unclear how many seniors are living on the streets in the U.S. In many places, including Arizona's Maricopa County, which includes Phoenix, Scottsdale, and Tempe, the number of homeless seniors is on the rise. Amy Schwabenländer of Valley of the Sun United Way looked at the available data in the county and...
From 2014 to 2017, in looking at this, what is a bit alarming is that the population 62 years and older has increased by 70% in that time span. It's hard to know without digging into more details why, because the average age of a person experiencing homelessness is 45.
The data is unlikely to surprise those working with this population. In fact, in January, the Maricopa Association of Governments started tracking people 62 and older for the first time in its annual homeless street count after hearing from emergency shelters and service providers that more older adults are accessing services. Lukowitz says there are two types of people Justice Center serves. The chronically homeless, like Q, which is a nickname given to her by staff.
Outside.
Yeah, Q, where is your cart?
Outside. Yeah.
Will you show her where your cart is?
And those who are in emergency shelters. And Lukowitz says many more seniors, ones that had never experienced homelessness before, are accessing services at Justice Center. Here's Daniel Borquez.
Those are the ones that I really feel for, the new ones, because they have no understanding of the streets and what it's like out here. They get gamed on by people.
Borquez is 67. He spent most of his life in and out of prison. He got out in 2006.
And everything changed. The phones, technology, computers, all that stuff. That stuff was all new to me. It was real scary. I wanted to hurry up and go back.
Like Denise Holm and Rudy Solis, Borquez started volunteering at Justice Center. He was eventually offered a job. It's almost lunchtime, and the main room is filled with seniors carrying backpacks stuffed with personal belongings. A tiny woman with long, matted gray hair walked in for the first time, using a walker. Another man in a wheelchair was dropped off after being released from a skilled nursing facility.
Not everyone is going to be able to stay in their own house. Not everyone is going to be able to age in place. And so those are the people that Justice Center is going to have to help.
Lukowitz says that's something we as a society have to consider. What will it take to address the needs of our most vulnerable? She says political will and community activism are key, and ultimately, solutions take money and manpower, something Lukowitz and her team know all too well. For Here and Now, I'm Kathy Ritchie.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.